So, our next workshop is in the crosshairs, how to deal with heirs' property. This was a topic that came up during our last symposium, loud and clear, that it's a big issue for our community. In order to get SHIP money, in order to get anything done with the housing here, the titles need to be clear, and how to get there is a big problem. So we've asked a few experts to come and help us start the process on how to be helpful in this. Ann Carpenter has come all the way from Atlanta. She's the Senior Community and Economic Development Advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, specializing in housing and neighborhood revitalization. Leslie Powell Boudreau is here, the Executive Director of Legal Services of North Florida, which provides representation to low-income and vulnerable individuals in civil matters. And Ed Bronwald has come, who's the Executive Director and Co-Founder of the North Florida Center for Equal Justice. So, we got a wealth of experience here, and I thank you all for coming. I'm also going to hold the portable mic, and that's going to be like our walking stick. So if you have a question, call me over, and we'll give you a mic so everybody can hear you in the audience. All right, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Holly, and thanks, everybody. Thank you so much for the invite. It's really nice to be here and on this beautiful day in Apalachicola. Again, I am from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, where I study housing, mainly affordable housing, rental housing, but also neighborhood revitalization issues. And so in some of that work, we noted that when we looked at blighted communities, small and large, heirs' property came up again and again as one of the contributing factors. And so that began a body of work that we started at the Atlanta Fed maybe 2 years ago. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the things we found, some of the solutions that we talked to partners about, and some of the resources that we also have available through our website and that I can share with you all. I do need to give the disclaimer, these are my comments, not those of the Federal Reserve System or the Bank of Atlanta. But with that said, I'll just give you a brief overview of the Federal Reserve. We get a lot of questions about why is the Fed interested in this particular issue, or you know, what are you doing here? So we are one of 12 regional banks, and in Atlanta we cover the Southeast. We have all of Florida, we have all of Georgia and Alabama, and then we have parts of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Tennessee. In our department, we focus on low and moderate income communities in these six states. We have a lot of ground to cover. My whole team is based in Atlanta, but we're out on the road quite a bit. The Federal Reserve is responsible for supervising and regulating banks, for the payment system, so cash and checking, as well as monetary policy, so setting discount interest rates. But we also regulate the Community Reinvestment Act, or CRA. And that was adopted in the late 1970s to address redlining and discriminatory lending practices. So CRA is the reason why community affairs departments like my own exist within the system. And each of our 12 banks really have a different strategy for kind of addressing these issues, but we all kind of work at a common mission to activate economic development and social and financial and human capital in low and moderate income communities. Again, we do this through kind of different buckets of areas of expertise. I work in housing and neighborhood revitalization, but we also look at workforce development and small business, entrepreneurship, and community development finance, for example. And we do a lot of evidence building. We do some kind of research within our district on trends and things that we're tracking, like heirs' property. And then we also do a lot of outreach. So we travel all across our district to communities like this to talk about the issues and to help to bring together the other experts who really know that these issues much more deeply, but bring to bear kind of the resources and experiences of our department as well. So again, one of the things that we've really been picking up on in our district, in rural areas, in urban areas, and in small towns, is this issue of heirs' property. And I will get into a very basic definition of this, but I just wanted to show up hands of how many people are familiar with the term. Basically, how many feel that they know quite a lot about heirs' property? Okay, great. So we've got a mix here. This is my overview slide to kind of talk about why we think it's important, what it is, and this is all kind of based on actually a convening that we did in June of last year that we co-hosted with the Forest Service, a very interesting partnership between the Federal Reserve and the Forest Service, and the Georgia Heirs Property Law Center, which is a legal aid provider in Georgia looking at heirs property. And so at that event last year, we pulled together a lot of academics, a lot of technical service providers, and other experts who've been really working on this topic since, in some cases, the 1970s, when it really started to emerge, especially in rural areas of the South, and Black-owned land issues. So heirs property is essentially when someone either dies intestate, meaning without a will, or actually they die with a will that creates heirs property. So this means that by default in probate court, all of the heirs are joint owners of the property. So depending on what generation you come from, you own a different proportion of the land, but that doesn't mean that you actually own a sectioned off discrete piece of land. You all own this plot as an undivided interest among the heirs. That's problematic for many reasons, familial conflicts being one, makes it very vulnerable to land disputes, but also to third parties coming in and forcing a partition sale. So, for example, you have a land speculator who buys out one of the heirs and then forces essentially the rest of the heirs to sell, and they end up not getting fair market value for this property, and the property is lost. And this happened pretty regularly over the last 50, 60 years. I'll talk a little bit about some protections that have recently been enacted to help to curb that practice. But when you have heirs property, and even if it's stable and no one's trying to get it from you, you don't have your marketable titles. That leads to a lot of issues. We talked about the ship funding and a lot of government and private loans and grants that aren't available to you. So it's important for that reason. It's also important for communities because it can lead to abandonment of the property and therefore blighted conditions, safety conditions, safety problems. The community will have a loss of tax revenue that they could otherwise recoup, and lower property tax value, property values. So, we talked a little bit about the neighborhood stabilization program and how, all of those foreclosed homes were kind of bringing down appraisal values, and a similar thing might happen in this case. We also know from years of research and all of the existing data that this is disproportionately affecting African American and other ethnic minority groups, as well as low-income households, households with lower education, and in particular the rural South. We see quite a preponderance of this problem. This is an example of heirs property happening within a family. So this is an example from the Louisiana Appleseeds website. So you have a woman who lives with her kids in her mother's house, this kind of intergenerational familial setting. If the mother dies without a will and the daughter continues to live in the property, maybe not understanding that there wasn't a probated will and that she doesn't have title to the property, at some point she might want to sell that property, downsize, whatever, get some value back out of it, some equity out of it. And what happens is you find that you can't sell the property for market value. The buyer won't accept the property with an unclear title or some other set of contributing factors that make this the value of the home basically lost to this family. And so going back to that that issue of Black-owned land and how it's particularly affected this population. So these are data that your chart here, going back to Reconstruction era and up to the present, and you can see, especially with Black-owned farmland, we've seen a major increase in acquisition of land during Reconstruction and after the Civil War, where many, many Black-owned farmers, especially in the South, started off their own businesses. And then really around 1920, you see this precipitous decline in Black-owned land. And a lot of that, based on reports and studies that were done, especially in the 60s and 70s, was really due to heirs property and these partition sales that I mentioned. So about 80% of that loss we can attribute to the heirs property problem. We're not going to get that land back easily because now it's privately owned. It might be owned, it might have been kind of conglomerated by other corporate farmers or some stuff, but it's definitely, it's lost. And what we know now is that we still have a large proportion of AIRS properties with around our communities. There's a lot of different estimates because data are pretty scarce, but some estimates think it's as high as 30% of all residential rural lands. Again, it's highest in rural areas, we believe, but it's also found in small towns. It's definitely found in urban areas. And in some of our data crunching, we think we're kind of looking at a meta-analysis of other studies combined with some of the property data we have access to, which I'll show in a moment. It could be around 10 to 15% of all residential properties, urban and rural, in the southeast, which is quite a large number, actually. But we also know that AIRS properties are going to continue to be formed. Actually, less than half of all, about 44% of all adults do not have a will in place at this moment in time. And in the Black population, that's even higher. 72% of Black adults do not have a will in place. So what does this mean? If they have assets, if they have property, it's likely to become AIRS property in the future. So we just see this continuing to perpetuate. And I will say that, you know, I didn't know the term AIRS property until a couple of years ago. And then when I did figure out what it was, I realized that I have it in my own family. It's really common. And it's something that we don't talk about. It's something that, you know, you hear about these conflicts within people's individual families, but this is happening a lot, and this is something that I think we really need to devote more attention and resources to helping to preserve that family wealth and make sure that folks, if they want to, can do something with their family land that has significance financially and culturally to them. So I mentioned some early data. These are this is a study from Duke University on Black-owned land in 1976. And this is, again, kind of showing those startling statistics where Black ownership went from about 15 million acres of agricultural land to 5.5 million in 1969. I think it's at like 3 million at this point, so it's even lower. But I also wanted to show this map, and you can see where it's kind of hard to read, but these are concentrations of Black-owned land, with the darkest areas being the areas with the highest concentrations across the southeast and southwest, I guess, a little bit as well. And so what we did at the Fed, when we first heard about or started thinking about this issue, we thought, with all of our data that we have property-level data, we have deeds data, we have extraordinary data that we have access to for our economic analyses, that we would be able to quickly pull together some statistics and help to target our resources towards technical assistance and other kind of solutions to this problem. And what we found from our data is that it's really inadequate. So only a few counties really code these properties as AIRS properties in terms of ownership type. Tenants in common is another common term for this. You might also find some signifiers in the owner data at the tax assessor level, which would say something like so-and-so et al. You know, there's some things that we can use to kind of get at the fact that a property might be AIRS property.
Excuse me, I have a question. Some of these slides say Black-owned land, and this slide says, some of these slides say Black-owned land. Mm-hmm. This slide says residential real estate.
Yeah.
Were you, the big map that you showed, were you talking about undeveloped land, or are you talking about whole land? I mean, there's a distinction between that land that's rural and not developed, a farm versus residential property. So is it developed or undeveloped?
Absolutely. So this 1976 study, it's just Black-owned land, so it's mostly agricultural. I actually don't know for sure if they did commercial, but they would do homesteads and agriculture, and this is because it's a U.S. Agricultural census data. But then when we went back to our data, we looked at, we only have access to residential real estate data at the property level. So I just did this as a comparison, so you can kind of like, just by glancing at it, see that there's a similar pattern that, you know, this is almost 40, 50 years later, that we still see that Black-owned land has become AIRS property in many of these areas. Or I can't say for sure that that was the direct causation, but that there is some sort of relationship between those patterns, spatial patterns. But you're right, one is mainly agricultural and residential, and one is all residential, excluding agriculture. And yeah, these are national data that we have, so really good coverage of residential parcels. And it's pretty striking that you can see Alabama, Mississippi and Georgia, some of those counties in the Black Belt South really show high concentrations, up to 11%, and these are by far underestimations of this issue because of the data reporting the lack of data reporting. And in Florida, you can see that Black-owned land levels in 1976 weren't particularly high throughout the state, and slightly more in the Panhandle, but that in the present day data, the residential data, the green data at the bottom, you can see that there's some counties that certainly have higher concentrations of heirs property based on known numbers. So again, these are underestimations just given the available data that we have today. Is that answered? All right, so just to go through a few of the consequences to families and then also to communities, which I think many of you are most likely aware of, and I've alluded to the fact that heirs property ownership does follow Black-owned property land trends, and is leading to this well-established racial wealth gap that we see. I mean, there's reports that it would take 200 years for a Black family, this is from Prosperity Now, to obtain the amount of wealth that the average white family has in today's kind of conditions, which is just striking and shocking. And so if this continues unabated, you know, there's quite a lot of wealth and assets that are being continually lost, and that's disproportionately affecting the Black population and other ethnic and racial minorities. But this is also associated with out-migration, so a lot of these heirs maybe move to another state. They might not be aware that they own this property, which is one of the complications when you're doing title clearing, is tracking down all these family members who maybe generations ago left the area and maybe aren't really interested in owning this property. So what do you do about that? Again, joint owners are unable to access different types of equity, loans, and mortgages. Talking to folks at the Forest Service, our partner on the event last year, you can't even sell the timber off your land if you don't have your title. So there's not a lot of productive use of the land that's available to the family members. And again, you can't get local, state, or federal aid. And after a disaster, this continually comes up with the FEMA grants and other sort of aid products that are out there from the state and federal level. There is a higher likelihood of tax default, especially if it's a property that's been abandoned. And then again, that higher likelihood of forced partition action, so some third party coming in and taking the property. So at the community level, I think it's, as a planner, as my background, I think it's really important to note that we're losing a lot of sensitive land, and I'll talk a little bit about some examples of that. So some of these properties weren't productive for farming, but they had wetlands, or they had you know, some other kinds of environmental assets that are being lost, and then you know, some of them are ex-urban areas or areas that are ripe for urban sprawl to occur. So we're losing, you know, sensitive and you know, potentially conservation land, essentially. We also see that this ownership leads to these blighted conditions with health and safety issues. We talked about that. There's been studies that landowners in general tend to be more civically engaged, running for office and voting and generally participating in civic life. So that's another, you know, thing that you might consider. It's a reason to maintain that kind of place attachment and people's ties to their land. Again, it complicates disaster recovery and just redevelopment of distressed areas. And, you know, I note this again that for me, coming at this as a data person, trying to study the issue and working with many other researchers who have, it's extremely difficult to track and gauge this issue. And so there's been people who have been modeling kind of demographic and economic factors that are likely to produce heirs property, and there's some success there. But really, I think what needs to be done is probably better record keeping at the county level, or better surveys to update some of that data that we have from 1978 and 76, which is quite outdated. I'll give a couple examples that I think are interesting and maybe can help to spur some ideas for your community. So one of the bigger case studies, or one that gets a lot of attention, is South Carolina's coast and the barrier islands where the Gullah Geechee communities live. So these are communities that were once very isolated. They actually still maintain their dialect. I think it's an Eastern African dialect. their cuisine and their culture, and it's quite extraordinary. But because of development pressures on the island and the desirability of these lands, their enclave in Sabalo Island and other areas of the Carolina coast is seeing encroachment. And there was actually a report in The Nation, if anyone saw it, about a particular family that went through a partition sale and lost their family property. And so, you know, you're seeing, because of the increase in land values, tax increases as well, 540% was reported in one area of the New York Times. One of the solutions, Beaufort County in South Carolina on the coast, has actually done something still a little bit risky, but when they have a tax delinquency sale, they allow the heirs themselves to bid first. And so it's kind of a gentleman's agreement. So there's still a risk that some kind of outside party will come in and purchase the property. But there's been you know, kind of that tradition in place to help to maintain these properties within those families. But we do know, you know, again, data are scarce, but it's estimated that almost 20% of the properties in McIntosh County nearby are potentially heirs' properties. And that value of $173 million is quite high. So there's probably a lot of people interested in that land presently. Another example, I noted that we have some urban examples that we sort of led off with in our study of blight as probably one of the first inroads to understanding heirs' property. So in Atlanta, we have some kind of shotgun houses, some housing stock similar to what we're talking about today. And this is a neighborhood near the brand new football stadium that the Falcons just built. And what we're finding is that there's a lot of resources and there's a community benefits agreement to help to keep the current inhabitants in the area, but it's a high rental population. I think 70% of them are renters. And we do see a large number of heirs' properties in the community. So this is really complicating that matter. Speculators are coming in, gentrification is beginning to occur, and it's very difficult to get a handle on keeping things affordable. I mean, community land trusts, I hope they're looking at it. It's caused a lot of concern over the years with crime. The city of Atlanta has estimated that $6 million per year on police, fire, and code enforcement and cleanup are spent on blight and abandoned properties alone. So, you know, again, it's an area that we want to revitalize, but for the existing inhabitants, but it's actually been quite a difficult matter because of the heirs' property. There's a few mitigation strategies I'll go through, and I know we'll talk more about that, I think, in the later part of the session, but certainly one of the top things that are being done and that needs to be done with that large percentage of heirs' property, 30, 15% of all land, whatever it is to offer legal services to resolve these title issues and make sure that people can get clear title, that families can kind of resolve these property issues before they blow up. A second thing, and a lot of the legal services community members, folks that we talk to in the technical assistance side are doing this, is education on estate planning and the use of wills and making sure you prepare a will that doesn't create heirs' property. We hear that a lot from our colleagues at the Georgia Heirs' Property Law Center. There are also a lot of different groups that are looking at protecting the land and also sustainable utilization of the land. And so these are folks like the Federation of Southern Cooperatives and Forest Service and USDA and working on microgrants and different programs to help the family members who want to remain on the land come up with strategies to make it productive and useful financially for the family. A couple other tools. I've talked to folks about just making probate court. One of the barriers to probating your will is the expense. Another is maybe just distrust. And so reforming it in certain ways to make it more accessible, but also there's a transfer on death deed tool that's been used in Texas where you don't even have to probate that. It's just the deed itself transfers over to whoever you name as your heir. There's quiet title actions for properties that have been tax delinquent. State by state, that can differ as to how many years you have after you've paid off the tax liens before you can get the quiet title and the property itself. And I'm going to add data collection as well, because again, we need more information about where this is occurring and where we need to target resources. There's one more tool at the state level that I wanted to mention. The Uniform Law Commission came up with a state level Partition of Heirs Property Act, which has been adopted in, I think, 9 states and introduced in a few others. Florida is not one that has introduced it. I think there's a little bit of interest, but so far nothing too substantial. But this law is really meant to prevent those partition sales that I mentioned. So it includes due diligence to find all of the heirs. It includes, if a sale occurs, you have to get fair market value for the property, which includes the cultural value of the land. So very interesting way to determine that versus kind of the older methods where courts would determine very low values for these properties. And it also gives the heirs the opportunity to buy out their family members if they wish to keep the property. So a right of first refusal. And just a couple other things before I close. So we do have a lot of resources on the Atlanta Fed's community development website. We have an infographic. I'm sorry I didn't print it out. I actually meant to do that. But it's available online to be printed and in high res. We also have a podcast that we did with Thomas Mitchell, who's one of the leading legal scholars in this area, and Cassandra Johnson from the Forest Service. We have some articles that are meant more for a general audience. And from our conference in June, we're actually working on a proceeding. So all of the experts, the researchers, the legal scholars, and the technical assistance providers will be writing pieces or essays about their work. And so that should be coming out by the end of the year. So thank you very much. And I guess I could take questions now, and then we'll do more later, probably.
Do you have a question for Anne?
I just want to ask, because I worked in banking in Georgia and Florida, another huge problem is the fact that there are often not surveys, and then the meets and bounds, and so forth. So right here in Franklin County, in East Point, there are numerous properties that are, forget the terminology, but there's no way you can buy them because there's no way to settle all the, you know, the questions about, you know, 15 feet from the corner of the tree and all this. So I didn't know if you dealt with any of those issues.
So they were subdivided, but it wasn't recorded properly at some point?
No, they're you know, it's just, they'll take it from this corner of the section and go 300 feet, yeah. And then they'll use that to subdivide it to the other people. And then you end up with, you know, a block of land that there's no way you could ever buy it because everybody, you know, and it's not the county's burden here at all. I don't know how many properties there are, particularly in the East Point area.
Yeah.
That I don't think we've ever dealt with that, when particularly, you know, urban or semi-rural or so forth, with a terrible problem that is almost Georgia.
Yeah. I have heard of, like in New Orleans, that's a big problem, and certain other reasons for that as well. But what they've done is like a lot next door program. So if you own a property and there's one of those, you know, kind of oddly shaped and unclear, you can basically just start using it, and then I think after some amount of time, you can purchase it very
you
easily.
You've got to meet the zoning requirements with the footage.
Yeah, I mean,
all that right. Is part of it, you know,
it's not useful for anything else, yeah. It's one. Yes?
Please excuse me, I missed the opening remarks, so you may have touched on this, but there are legal categories, and then there's life. What is an heir?
An heir is just someone like your child or your grandchild. I think that's for probate court,
is. Heirs at law are determined by statute or code in terms of a definition. For instance, Florida has an intestate succession statute, and it sets out who the legal heirs are, including those like after adopted folks who have paternity established at a later date, all those kinds of things. But it's really kind of the lineal succession from someone here. And it's pretty simple but complicated only because it's statutory, it's codified.
Related primarily by blood. I mean, not only exclusively by blood.
Well, it's, yes, but taking into account issues of adoption, taking into account issues of after-acquired paternity, and taking into account marriage, certainly, and taking into account beneficiaries who are established by other means, for instance, a will, for example. It wouldn't necessarily be an heir, but it might have some descriptive or defined information in the instrument that would establish their relationship with the decedent.
Should we let them go ahead and then do more questions?
We have one more question and then, yeah.
Thank you, Ian. That was a really interesting presentation, and my question may be more towards the panel, but has there any work been done on a legal remedy for those groups of heirs who do not want to divest themselves of the property or have devolved to one owner? They would like to continue to own it as a family, but they need some tools so that they can have access to disaster relief and sell the timber and do all of those things. So short of forming a family corporation, is there a remedy for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think really what you're looking at is just promise a remedy in a contract. It's about the reaching an agreement between the owners. And, you know, FEMA, for example, it's kind of they look at it as a first come, first served process. One, it has to be somebody who's living in the home. If you're not living in the home, they can't apply for it. But if you've got multiple people who live in the home, then they look at it as a first come, first serve. Whoever gets their application in first gets that benefit for that house. And it's actually an issue that we see with some frequency where you've got competing interests of who's going to get that money. And what ultimately happens is FEMA has to decide who the legitimate owner is. And if they don't have any other thing to ground that in, they will base it on who files first. And if the parties involved all want ownership, if they don't reach an agreement as to what that looks like in advance, then that often does end up in family disputes.
Well, I guess my question is there a way that in advance a group of heirs can say, okay, we want to continue to own this as a group of heirs, but we need some legal remedy that will allow us to interact with the rest of the world as if we have clear and undisputed title as an entity?
There's no as if we have.
Okay.
And the fact of the matter, I think Leslie said initially, really the remedy is in contract, which is not necessarily a written contract, but should be. Mm-hmm. It's dealing with real estate. But it has to do with there may be folks, and I've run into it numerous times, where really in a long pen. I mean, in Georgia and Florida, I mean, where there are folks who are set in terms of not wanting things to change. And they don't want the timber cut. And they don't want something done. And so it's a touchy situation for family members, but my experience has been that if there are not these sorts of personal issues, like if it's just a business decision, and some people don't want things to change, and it's a business decision for them in terms of how they live their life, then it usually can be worked out. And along the same lines of the other question that was said about surveys and plats and legal descriptions, there's always a way. That's my answer, having dealt with it for a long time. The question is, do you have the time and do you have the money? But there's always a way to resolve a legal description, and there's always a way to resolve a family dispute, maybe not even a dispute. I mean, sometimes there are like these organic issues that death will solve, but and then the children don't care and they will cooperate. you know, part of the issue is that the very basis of real property ownership in the South and in North Florida is that you own your piece of land. And even if you own it jointly with other people, you have your right as an individual property owner here. And the South's a little different, I've always felt, because it's a place where people had their little piece of heaven. Like, they may not be worth anything. If you're out there in the middle of Tate's Hill or somewhere and you had your little place, it may not be worth a bunch of money, but it's your place. And it was a way to establish your independence as a person. And so it means more in the South. And it's a real issue, I understand that. But I have found over the years that typically if people are earnest and want it to be resolved, meaning the majority of them, you can find a way. Usually involves lawyers or folks in other professions, but you can usually find a way.
Thanks. Thank you. First of all, with the, you know, the data part of it is very interesting. We did a, at Save Our Shotguns, we did a survey of 1,000 lots on the hill, which is part of the historic district. Found about 10% of the houses were empty historic structures. So, and there are more empty buildings than that. So it's a huge issue. But to elaborate a little bit on what Bon was saying is that one thing I've learned living in that area is that, you know, there is an upside to the joint ownership of these houses in that, like right now, there's a family reunion going on up two blocks from us, and the whole family comes back to that house. So, you know, we've wondered, is there some form of trust, something like that, that could be a legal entity, you know, where the family not necessarily at odds or anything, it's just they want to jointly own it because it's where they all come together. That would allow them to benefit from, you know, government programs, SHIP, FEMA, whatever, and have a structure so that it's not not going to waste, because a lot of times I think what happens here is that nobody wants to invest in it because they don't have clear ownership, so it just becomes, you know, a dream in somebody's head of, you know, this wonderful place that used to live.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is, and I think someone else may have a different comment, but my experience has been over the years that there are lots of vehicles to reach that conclusion to get there. And a trust is certainly one way that will sustain itself past death. There are ways to form business organizations, LLCs, for instance, family limited partnerships, all kinds of things that will extend the ownership past the persons who are breathing now, but will sustain it in terms of, now there are lots of issues involved with real property and restraint on alienation and all that. We don't really like that. But to do it with a separate independent entity allows you to kind of do what you're talking about, make it something that can be an asset for a family structure, but takes the burden of individual decision making away, kind of makes it like a business. And the problem, though, it's not really a problem, but it's a challenge, is making sure that everyone at some point buys in. Doesn't mean they have to pay, but they buy into the concept. Then maybe it will sustain itself past them through their children or whatever, and it kind of will cross generations. And you know, in the best case scenario, it allows for resources to improve the property if it's a structure, etc. And that led me back to one thing that was said in the previous presentation, and the difference between like land or unimproved land and residential real estate. And frankly, in the South, especially with minority-owned property that historically was acquired post-Civil War, it always was residential real estate. It did include 20 acres, 40 acres, but the sustainability of a family was part of that. So it wasn't as if it was just timberland. This whole jag with timberland in the South has been a creation of post-World War II, essentially. And so I don't think we can erase the problem of taking away resources from communities by separating it into unimproved and residential. It's different in the South. And it's different down here on the coast. And I don't know, the map had some areas that I don't know if you look on the panhandle, but North Florida is kind of South Georgia, kind of North Florida. I mean, and some of the same problems. So, you know, I've done a good bit of that over the years where you structure some kind of entity to get it past the folks there, but it does require some cooperation. But most people I've found over the years, it's not that they are completely against it, it's that they don't want things to change. And if they can have enough of an assurance from the players that their role is not going to change and this it's not going to change, then they usually can be controlled into it.
And the challenge that exists in probating that property still exists with that kind of model. You still have to know who all the heirs are, you still have to find them. So if there is some heir and lineage who nobody knows where, you know, Cousin Joe went 20 years ago, and whether or not Cousin Joe had kids who are also potential heirs, then it still, you still have to get all that buy-in from all of the people.
And I mean, it is complicated.
One other question is that I saw that some of the information on there came from Prodigy. I tried to contact them about a year ago in Florida. Do they exist?
There's not an Apple Seed in Florida. They're in several states, Georgia, Alabama. I mean, there are lots of them, but there's not an Apple Seed project in Florida at this time, unless they just came. No, and I had talked to some of the folks in Georgia at various times about it. It's a really interesting concept, but no, there's not.
What is it?
But it's a nonprofit organization that operates on a model of having a management group in it and a public board of directors. Usually there are lots of people from entities around the community or the state. And then a lot of legal work is done by pro bono lawyers as well as some of the paid staff. And they work on obviously contributions and grants, but they have a lot less restrictions on them than some other entities do.
And it's a good advocacy work.
Oh, yeah.
Before we go any further,
Wesley
and Ed, do you have anything you would like to say?
I'm with Legal Services in North Florida. We provide civil legal assistance to low income and vulnerable populations from Jefferson County over to Escambia County. And when Ann and I first talked, I kind of shared with her some of our history in getting into title clearing work and what we do. I actually was the managing attorney of our principal office when Hurricane Ivan came through. And that wasn't kind of my first dabble in this work, but it certainly was an opportunity in both the more urban and suburban parts of Escambia County, as well as the rural counties, to see some of the title issues that really just haven't been unearthed in a few decades. And it took probably about 10 years worth of conversation and a few more disasters before the county really became ready to invest in resolving those issues. It was actually after the floods in 2014 in Escambia County that they opted to take some of their CDBG funds and to pay for legal services for those residents who could not get SHIP, could not get other funding, FEMA could not get all the things that Julian talked about, can't even insure their homes so that they could get insurance. And so they invested in us providing legal services to residents that were having title issues and having issues with ownership. Sometimes that's a probate. We talked a little bit about tax work. Sometimes it's helping a family resolve a tax default. If there's somebody living in the home and they haven't quite figured out how to pay those taxes, or they weren't getting the tax bills for some reason and they find out about a tax sale, we can actually help them remedy that without having to come up with a lump sum at once. Chapter 13 bankruptcy or reorganization can give them the ability to pay that off for a short period of time. It's sad the number of people, and I think it's maybe something that I'm hearing a little bit, at least rumblings up. It's horrible to see somebody lose the family wealth, the family home, over $1,500 worth of taxes. And so that's another piece of the resolution that can fit into this puzzle that helps families stay in their homes without having to come up with these really kind of insurmountable amounts of money that they may not have known or owed before. So there's a lot of different issues, but what we've been able to do with that project has really been able to get clear title, get people with the ability to get SHIP funds, improve the health of their families, improve the health of and the quality of life that they have. What was fortunate is in 2016, this family got hit by two tornadoes. So we already had this program, but it got hit in particular in northern Escambia County, which is an incredibly rural part of the county. There's not a lot of people there. There's not much industry, if any, at all. And the survey issue that you raised is one that we have seen there, where the property descriptions don't match where the house actually exists. And really working through a lot of those problems, it was, again, through that partnership with the county and their other funding sources that we were able to get some of that surveying done. And I think one solution, which was fairly unique, is they actually said, look, your house is really kind of beyond repair. Why don't we just move you to the property where your title matches and help you build a house there? And again, it was that partnership with us helping the clients and the government stepping in and recognizing the problem that really has helped that to work. Another project that we're working on, which is actually a statewide project, Bay Area Legal Services, our partners in Tampa, received some funding through the Legal Services Corporation and brought in several of us to partner to work on title clearing. And it was intended to be disaster preparedness. We ended up launching it around the same time Hurricane Irma came through, so there's some disaster response part to it as well. But it is what strengthens this partnership is that the real property probate and trust law section of the Florida Bar has committed to this project. And so they're coming in as volunteers to help clear title. So it's not just relying on the limited staff that we have as legal services programs, but really training others to do this kind of work to help clear title and for them to do it on a volunteer basis. So that project just started in October, and we're really moving that forward right now. And as a legal services entity that serves Franklin County, when Anne reached out and mentioned that this was happening, I'm thrilled that we were able to come and have this conversation. I'm looking at today as a conversation for us to kind of see what's going on, for you to know a little bit about what we do. If there's some role that we can play, or that we can get private attorneys down here to play in helping to resolve some of the issues that you're seeing, I think that it is part of our mission, and it's important to the community for the reasons that Anne really shared through her presentation. I will say, on the pro bono side, we have a really, Ed mentioned a little bit about the complexity of the issues. What we're seeing now is attorneys are volunteering, and then they're getting the cases that we're finding, and they're saying, wow, that's going to take years. I don't want to take that as a pro bono case. How am I going to do that? So we're trying to find ways to work through that trepidation that the lawyers are feeling about committing to cases that are going to take a while, to find all those multiple errors, to work through the survey issues. And so those are, you know, we're problem solving that piece of it right now. But it is complex, and it's not an easy solution. And Ann talked a little bit about the estate planning and, you know, getting ahead of it, having wills and having documents in place. That's a really key piece to this, because otherwise we're just creating a continuing problem. But I also think we're going to be solving the problem of their title for decades to come, even with that, just because of how it's been missing. You know, one little kind of anecdotal piece to that is we actually get funding from the Department of Elder Affairs to represent individuals over the age of 60. And one of the areas that they don't want to fund is estate planning and advance directives. And we can do it in an emergency, so if somebody's in hospice or on a deathbed or something like that, then they absolutely support that we do that. But the real planning, when you're not really in that urgency and you're thoughtful about it, is not something that they really want us to do. So there's a lot of push-pull in policy, I think, on this issue and what's really important and how it affects. And we are starting, because we're pretty vocal about it, we're starting to see some changes on that front. But I think there are some challenges with people thinking, well, everybody can pay $500 and get a basic will done, and poor people don't own much anyways, so why not? And to a poor person, $500 is, you know, that may be the difference between, you know, electricity for the year. I mean, that's a challenge. So, and I guess, you know, one piece that I kind of skipped over is we're also seeing title issues in the foreclosure realm. And we have seen it in places where people obviously got a loan, can't afford to pay it, or the original homeowner passes away, and whoever's living in the home and should be the heir can't afford to pay the mortgage, and that's probably the more traditional. But we did have a case recently where foreclosure was filed on a family, not because they had gotten a mortgage, but because the neighbors had gotten a mortgage, and the property description was wrong in the mortgage document. So title clearing has its layers and its of when it's important and why it's needed and it's why we do the work. But it's hard to prepare for what's going to be the issue in any individual housing situation, because the history of the house, the history of the loans, the history of the people involved in it, every situation is different. It's rare when it's rare when it's just, you know, the kids want to sell a house and everything's fine. I think that may be more likely in middle class than in poor families. I don't think it's likely,
period.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, there's as much fighting across age, gender, anything.
Thank you, Molly. I wanted to follow up on that Barbara Sanders. I do some of your program. I know where John just said, Craig is John. Yeah. I can clear any title in the world. You can have time and have many, but you gotta get the surveyor time. Because the final thing to clear a title is a judgment from a judge that says, here are the things. Now, we do that by searching sometimes old census records to see who great great grandmother was, you know, how many children were in the house, and you have to track all that. Which goes to your point, yes, you can do a trust, but without quite a title to say, these are the right people who are the parties to this agreement, it's always subject to attack. And I look at title from a title insurance point of view, because that's what we mean to say marketable. But what I don't understand in the discussion is the goal to maintain your property and the minority hands, or is the goal to make it marketable so it can be sold for whatever? That's
my opinion. I think it's different perspectives. Yeah, I think there are different perspectives on that. And I mean, from my perspective, and I can really hear, I think the issue is that we have clients who qualify for our services based on income or particular unique structure of their lot. And usually that means they're poor. And there's a disproportionate number of minority folks in this country who are poor. And so to answer that question, our viewpoint usually is from someone coming in who is in danger of losing their house or their land, whether they're an owner amongst several or a single owner or being foreclosed on or whatever. So our perspective would be that to keep it, to help them figure out a way to keep it. I've been involved in other things where I represent, when I was in private practice in Georgia for years, and we represented folks who were whatever, speculators, or I wouldn't necessarily, that sounds bad, but folks who like to make money with real estate, and you spent your time trying to herd the cats in terms of heirs so you could put a piece of property together to develop it. And everyone likes that. Taxes go up, you have a bigger tax base, it looks prettier, and all those things. But from our perspective, it generally, the origin is that someone is desperate to keep their property.
So, and I appreciate that. So you solve that problem, you keep it for that person, but then that person is a
right, we try to, yeah, we do what the client wants. Sometimes we do estate planning kinds of things, you know, based on what their interests are. Sometimes people want to get it straight so they can sell it, you know, that's their purpose.
So, in the past, there's been instances like, well, in the present too, where, you know, no one in the family wants to keep the property, but then for various reasons, they don't get the fair market value. And so I think that that's another piece too. So it should be up to the family to decide what's done with the property. Or you might have one family member who's been paying taxes and living on the property and has a real connection to
that. That's why, I mean, that's all the time.
Yeah, and so without that, you know, if our partition act in place, those are the kinds of instances where the land is so vulnerable maybe there are some family members who lose out on either keeping that connection to the property or the whole family loses out on the value of the property. So I think it's sensible.
I have a question. It seems, in our experience, it doesn't become a problem until it is a problem. We live in this community and we've witnessed this issue several times since we've been here in the 5 years that we've been here. And it's not until somebody dies and they want to sell the house or they want to get the roof fixed or, you know, we've seen it firsthand, but, you know, the people who are affected aren't here now. So the question is, do you have experience in getting the word out? Where do we go from here to try to help before it becomes a family crisis and in danger of losing the house or whatever?
One piece that we haven't, Ann mentioned that I wanted to hit it a little bit harder. I mentioned the Northern Escambia project where we had one of the significant errors that we had with some of the families there is they simply didn't trust the system. They absolutely believed that if they filed a probate and did anything with their title to the property, that they were going to lose their home. And it was in the core of their being that they were going to lose their home. And it we were able to increase our outreach in that community and our presence in that community. I mean, it's a good hour from our main office in that county, and really build those relationships and build that trust. And that is, I think, really a big piece of that conversation. And I think, again, why I'm glad to be a part of this conversation is I think we're trying to explore ways now that we're hearing from this community the significance of the issue. I brought brochures. It's a very kind of almost a token gesture, but it's one of those things that what we find is somebody may not pick it up the first time they see it, they may read it once and throw it away, but it's that continuous hearing of it and almost hearing that someone else did it and it was okay, that almost has to happen before people can start feeling like it's safe for them to do it. And so this for sure is fairly basic, and it's called Why Should I Worry About Time Into My Home? And I brought 100 of them. Y'all can do with them what you want. You can make other copies of them. You can send it digitally. Any of those things are fine. Share them freely, because it is really part of an awareness campaign. You're right, some people don't realize it's an issue until it's an issue. They think, I'm getting the tax bills, I'm paying the taxes, I'm paying the mortgage, everything's fine, nothing's going to happen until it does. And so this tries to hit on a lot of those examples and at least maybe raise the question of, should I be asking if I should be doing something about the title to my home?
Can I ask?
No.
I'm sorry.
I have a question from the preservation point of view. Assuming that there is unanimity of goal by various family members to preserve what is on their property, some kind of improvement. For example, is a deed restriction a possible tactic, or what are the other strategies available that you've seen so that, for example, they may want to sell a house, but they don't want to have it torn down?
Yeah, there are, now, deed restrictions are particular to the parcel. So it doesn't control any kind of sort of neighborhood concept or street or any of that. But there are lots of ways to restrict usages within deeds if you want to. And I'm sure, but it affects value, obviously. And releasing deed restrictions, which has become a big issue in communities, also becomes an issue when you do that, because times change. I mean, those houses, like, that when we went and looked at some of the houses with Save Our Shot, that was just that had been highlighted, and those houses were there for a reason and a use at the time, and that has changed in some ways. Now, the families lots of times are around there some and still, and the houses have value. I'm not saying that, but there comes a time, and this is sort of what Ms. Sanders may have been saying about, you don't want to do things that affect marketability unless you're convinced that usage and custom will not change, which is foolish in our life. I mean, it changes. And so there are ways to answer your question. Some of them are fairly simple, but they have consequences too. So you kind of have to be careful about that. One thing I wanted to, and I don't know if that answered your question.
It doesn't, but it leads to some other questions which I'll hold for the moment.
Yeah. I wanted to piggyback on Leslie, what she said. With the North Escambia project, one of the big things was the buy-in by local government. I mean, that was really made it possible, I think. Now, I wasn't directly involved in it, but that was a huge part of viability of the project itself. And things that happen in small communities and locally require that sort of public buy-in. Typically, that means resources. Like in the North Escambia, that it was money. It was a way to generate resources to have folks available to do the work. And that's a big issue here, just like it is everywhere. It's a real part of the equation.
And I mean, well, the significant part of that was that the town of Century actually gave us an office in their town hall that we could have someone, and we had a computer, we had technology, and it gave us an ability to be present and for people to know where we were. And I see the gentleman in the back is asking.
I had a question. Now, if I myself at this property, and the gentleman right here next to me, Tom, offers me $5,000, and I take it, then I sold him my property. And that's, you know, all well and good. And so I don't think that a lot of people in the community don't have a problem with that, because you actually bought it fair and square. You know, you offered me $5,000 or $10,000, I sold it for $5,000 or $10,000. Yeah, maybe it worth a lot more, but you know, you gave me what I asked for.
Right.
And so that's just the nature of what's happening up there also. But I think that one of the issues that some of the community had is when someone steals the property, or if they didn't steal it, it appears, you know, it just, and then the word just go out, they're stealing property, you know, whether they did or not. But this one guy, he had spent a lot of years in prison, and but everyone in town knew that that was his house. And so what ended up happening is that the house was auctioned off for unpaid taxes. Well, he was in prison, couldn't really pay the taxes. And but it just, and everything kind of happened. He got out, and I mean, it was a short period of time, which he didn't really, you know, wasn't working or whatever, and the house was sold. I think it was, might have been going to a land trust or Clifford or something like that. But then, you know, the house was then resold. But I think that the issue was that I had in my mind, if they had gone to the gentleman and said, your house is getting ready to be sold on the courthouse step, you just got out of prison, you haven't long been out of prison, I'll give you something for your house. I give you something. Just because people are selling houses for cheap. So they're already selling land for cheap. You can get a lot for $10,000 or something. Well, if you actually would have given the gentleman something for it, because it was a house, people lived there, then it may have gone over better than just to do it the way it was done, and then just bring a truck up, haul the house, throw it in a dump truck, and haul it off. The whole community sees that, see whether it was fair or not, because it was all legal. But still, people see that and feel that there was something underhanded done. Yeah, it was legal, we know that, but it seems like he could have gotten something for that property rather than just to see it get nothing.
One thing that we see with some regularity, I won't say frequency, but we see it often enough is someone owes taxes or owes something and they can't afford to pay it. So there's some sort of a quasi-sale of the property for less than fair market value, with some understanding that the individual will be able to buy the house back later. And so, and I'm using that as a description because a lot of times that desperation of, I can't do anything else, so I'm willing to sell for less than fair market value, means that people may not read contract terms, or they may not think about the long-term consequences, or there may be things that are said that are not part of the writing that that never come to fruition, or that are misunderstood because they're only said and there's no true meaning in the minds. And that's a lot of times where we see it go wrong, and where we see that perception being a problem. And there are malintended people who do bad things, and sometimes that happens. But I think a lot of times they're well-intended, and it still looks bad, and it still has bad perception. And I don't know the circumstance you're talking, so I'm not going to pretend I know which of those two things it is. But I think the challenge is, I feel a little bit like this is a pitch, and it's not meant to be. If somebody is selling their house, they should get a lawyer to look at the documents. They should get some third party, at the very least, to look at the documents. Because if there's an emotional connection and there's that moment of desperation, that things get missed. And somebody who, and You know, we don't have a physical presence in Franklin County. We have folks who come down here from Tallahassee, probably not often enough, but as much as we can. And I think, you know, there's probably attorneys in Franklin County who are available, but might charge money to look at a document. And so I think those are some of the challenges that we look at from an access to justice, access to the courts perspective. I don't know that I have a great solution as to how that won't happen again, but I think those are problems that we need to solve. I think they're things that we need to talk about, because I don't want anybody not to get fair value for the property that they're selling. And I also don't want anybody to feel forced into terms that really aren't for the long term in their best interest.
I'm sorry, we have to wrap up. Ed, do you want to have the last
word? I don't know about the last word, but I just wanted to add one way to temper it down, to limit those kinds of situations is, again, when local community, local government buys in to this being similar to a school system, when this becomes an issue that they think is a community issue, just like with neighborhoods that houses are not up to snuff and all this and you want to fix them up, it really becomes, when there's a mindset that we're going to make sure as a community that we have a position on this, and just like Century did, where they made legal help more available, then the citizens of the community become more comfortable in the actions of the other citizens, rather than there being somebody meeting on a corner or nobody saw a lawyer. You know, that's a mistake in my eyes when you're dealing with real estate, but hey, people do it. And if you have the more of a buy-in in the community, then you can avoid those kinds of situations.
All right, we have to wrap now, but I'm hoping our panel will stay for the afternoon session, and we'll have a lot of time this afternoon. We can ask them all of our questions, and you can continue this dialogue now. We're going to break for an hour for lunch, and